Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Well, today it's the ratings agency's turn on the hot seat. The Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission is hearing this morning from witnesses, including Warren Buffett, whose company owns a big share of Moody's. Moody's and other ratings agencies gave some of the most risky subprime mortgage securities their gold standard AAA rating before the financial crisis. So under scrutiny today, their business models, which include being paid by the same firms whose bonds they are rating. Here is Commission Chairman Phil Angelides. A short time ago, he used toasters as an analogy for mortgage securities.
After a while, if you found that 90% of the toasters you rated as safe had caught fire, you'd think that something was fundamentally wrong. Why did Moody's get it so wrong? Was it because of flawed ratings models? Was it because they were paid by the bankers whose securities they rated? Did a push for profits and market share skew their risk assessment? Was it a failure of corporate governance and management?
So that from the hearing a short time ago, we will dip back into the hearing live if there is something interesting taking place over the next few minutes as we talk to Andrew Ross Sorkin, the New York Times business columnist and chief mergers and acquisitions reporter and author of the book Too Big to Fail, the inside story of how Wall Street and Washington fought to save the financial system and themselves. Hi, Andrew. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you for having me again. It's great to talk to you.
Do you like that toaster analogy?
It's not a bad one. It's not a bad one. In the journalistic world, we talk about it slightly differently. The reference is if you were reviewing a restaurant and you were being paid by the restaurant, how would you feel as a reader? It's a little bit of a different anecdote, but that one's been going around our office. So.
Is that the central question on the table today, as you see it?
I think that is probably the biggest question about the model, if you will, their business model. They are being paid by the people who they are rating. And what does that mean? Senator Carl Levin referred to it as if you were paying the judge. You were in a court case, and you were paying the judge for his decision. What kind of decision do you think you're going to get? We had this situation, by the way, with research analysts. You know, this was a large issue almost 10 years ago about how the Wall Street research analyst world worked, where people were research analysts were effectively being paid in an odd way for their quote-unquote objective research. How objective is all of this?
Listeners, I wonder if we have anybody listening right now who works or who has ever worked for one of the ratings agencies. Do you want to defend this business model, or do you want to call in as anonymous? You can all use the name Warren from Manhattan, as if you were Warren Buffett, to say, hey, I work for this industry and it's corrupt, or not. Or anybody else who works for a Wall Street firm where some of the products were rated by these ratings agencies. Call up and tell us, as somebody who's had direct experience here, what you think of this hearing today, what you think of their contribution to the financial crisis. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. We and the Financial Inquiry Commission and the world are really still trying to get to the bottom of all this, and here's a big piece of it, the ratings agencies. 212-433-WNYC for whatever you can contribute that you know about this world. 212-433-9692 or post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer's show. My guest, Andrew Ross Sorkin from The Times and author of Too Big to Fail. Andrew, how's Warren Buffett being cast here? As the wise old independent or as an investor in a possibly corrupt ratings agency business model, since his firm owns, I guess, about 13% of Moody's?
I think it's the latter, which is a new role for him. And I think you will see him give an opinion, and I'll give you the example. I had actually asked him about Moody's 2 years ago. I had been one of the people who had asked him why he was still an investor in Moody's at his annual meeting in Omaha.
So that was a little bit before the crash, right?
It was just right after the crash.
Okay.
This was right after the crash, and it was an important question, and a lot of shareholders, I think, were very curious about why he had hung on to his stake and why he hadn't done more as its largest investor to push them into better practices, if you will. And his answer was interesting, and it had a mixed reaction in the room. His answer was that, you know, he said, I'm a shareholder in Burlington Northern, or, for example, the railroad company, and I don't tell them, you know, what type of safety procedures they should practice. I own Coca-Cola. I don't tell them whether they should be doing the new Coke formula or the old Coke formula. I'm an investor, and I vote with my feet. If I don't like what you're doing, I sell my shares. If I do like what you're doing and think it's a good investment, I buy the shares. But that he doesn't think of himself as a quote-unquote activist investor who's supposed to get involved on a day-to-day basis with actually how the company is operating. He's also, by the way, not a board member. Oftentimes, when you're a major shareholder, you have a seat on the board and therefore have other responsibilities. He does not. Some people in the room, I think, thought that was a cop-out, and other people thought, you know what, that's actually the way investors are supposed to behave.
Do you think that's the way Warren Buffett has behaved in other realms of business over the course of his career? I mean, it sounds so passive for somebody who presumably knows so much about so many businesses.
In fairness to Mr. Buffett, I should say he's actually more passive than people expect when it comes to minority investments, meaning Berkshire has sort of two forms of investments. One is when they own an entire company outright. And in those cases, I think he's actually very involved in the practices and the way they are and the way they behave. On businesses where he has bought a handful of shares in the same way that you or I or someone else might do, though I should say in advance I'm not allowed to buy shares because of my role as a journalist, but it is a sort of passive role. He buys the shares and hopes they go up, and if they don't go up, he sells the shares. But he doesn't actually get involved. And I don't think actually most investors, with the exception of certain hedge funds like Carl Icahn and some others, where they actually try to change the behavior of the firm.
Is ratings agency reform addressed in the financial reform bill?
Brilliant question. Yes and no. There are two forms of the financial regulatory bill floating around. So first of all, we just need to acknowledge there's the House bill and then there's the Senate bill. There are huge distinctions between them. But there is a provision in the Senate bill, and both of these bills will have to get reconciled before the president signs off on them, where Al Franken, formerly of Saturday Night Live,
That's a cheap shot.
I was not. But just for the reference point for listeners who didn't appreciate Al Franken, Congressman Al Franken,
Senator,
made a terrific, brilliant suggestion, and it would be a new law that would effectively put the SEC as middleman between the rating agencies and the Wall Street banks that are issuing these securities, so that there's actually no competition in the marketplace, which is to say that if you're a Wall Street firm issuing a new security, you call up the SEC and you say, listen, we have this new security, we need to get it rated. And then the SEC, playing the middleman, would assign you to Moody's or S&P or whomever. But what it would prevent is this sort of shopping competition process where you go to Moody's, S&P, and Fitch, and each of them try to give you a higher and higher rating because they want your business.
Uh-huh. Is that the nature of competition between the ratings agencies?
There is an argument to be made that that's what's happened, that the process has become so perverted that people want the highest rating, and so they basically shop for the rating. Who's going to give me the highest rating? This process that Senator Franken has proposed actually, I think, would do away with that. I will also tell you, though, that there is very little support in Washington for that particular provision, and the betting line at the moment is that it's going to get struck.
Some of these senators used to work for places that would give me a lot more pause than Saturday Night Live. But do you like the Franken alternative? Do you like that model?
I think it needs to be refined, but I think theoretically it makes a lot of sense. At the same time, it also means, by the way, that we will have decided as taxpayers and as the government that these three firms, the S&P, Moody's, and Fitch, should still basically be in business, and we will be basically giving them the business. Right? We will be deciding that they should be in business, and we're going to actually make
them
money.
Right.
Others could come into the marketplace and compete in the sense that they could compete to get the SEC to put them on, you know, on their approved list. But I'm not sure what that really means. I mean, there are some serious issues about whether it's the right way to go or not.
Andrew Ross Sorkin, New York Times business columnist and author of the book Too Big to Fail, the inside story of how Wall Street and Washington fought to save the financial system and themselves. As we talk about the hearings that are underway right now in Washington into the role of the ratings agencies, the bond raters, in the financial crisis. And Ed in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Ed.
Hi. I've been waiting for years to tell the story that I have, which is the fact that I wrote a structuring spreadsheet for a boutique issuer of the subprime mortgage-backed securities. And as such, I had to understand the rating agencies in detail, and in particular, the Moody's model. I also was an adjunct professor of credit risk at the Polytechnic Institute of NYU. And as such, I felt like I had some expertise in this. Mm-hmm. And it was clear to me that the Moody's model was a joke. And the reason why it was formulated was simply so that there could be a stamp put on these things, AAA. And it was also clear to me that the amount of time and care that they were expending on coming up with this rating was nowhere near proportionate to the $250,000 that they were getting for these ratings. They were simply trading on their reputation, and frankly, I'm ashamed of Warren Buffett for not really understanding this.
So your story is from the early 90s.
No. What I said to your screener was that when I first got into finance in the early 90s, I was told about this conflict of interest as just part of a general education about how Wall Street works.
Yes.
It was only in 2003 and 2004 that I actually started doing this for a living, what I was telling you about.
And so you saw it close up. And was there any sense among your peers that they were getting bad information from the ratings agencies, or that investors really knew this?
They didn't care. And in all honesty, I thought about it myself, and I had two thoughts. The first was that, you know what, if I make a stink as just some little programmer somewhere, all right, I happen to have a PhD and a little bit of expertise, but nobody really would care what I had to say.
Thank you for your call, Ed. That's pretty interesting, Andrew. Do you think it's a widespread perception in the business that was kind of a dirty little secret that nobody ever talked about?
I think he's probably right to some degree. I think that people did understand this conflict and they did understand the problems. I don't think this was a secret. I think people did whisper about it within the industry. Having said that, in fairness, just to be fair to the rating agencies, I do want to say one thing, which is I'm not sure the entire industry was completely corrupt and every employee was sitting around, trying to figure out how to dupe the system, and that they actually thought all these things were going to fall apart and they didn't believe in their ratings. A lot of these employees actually, sadly, actually did believe in their ratings. They actually thought this stuff was AAA, but it represented sort of a larger group think about how they were approaching these things,
right,
how the models worked. And there wasn't an outside perspective questioning whether what was happening was the appropriate and right way to be doing it.
Yeah, and there's kind of a reverse scenario that I think has been floated by New York State Attorney General and gubernatorial candidate Andrew Cuomo recently, which is that the Wall Street investment firms actually duped the rating agencies by providing them bad and misleading information on these mortgage securities rather than the ratings agencies kind of toadying up to them.
You're correct. I think there's two pieces to that are interesting, though. The first is that if they really were being duped, and there is some evidence to suggest that they might have been in certain instances, for example, some of these banks and originators in particular would just write in people's FICO scores, made up FICO scores. So by default, that would be considered fraud. So there is an element to which they were duped. But the real question I have about the rating agencies is, I think even inside those firms, they had questions about whether they were being duped, meaning they recognized there was fraud, they recognized that there were problems, and didn't do anything about it. And the reason they weren't doing anything about it was because they were creating business for themselves. These were their clients. And so nobody was going to blow the whistle on their own clients.
Andrew, stay there for just a minute. We're going to dip in live to the hearing right now. testifying are four current or former executives from Moody's. I'm not going to give their names because nobody will recognize them anyway. But let's just listen a little bit of this discussion, which I think centers on home prices right now. Let's see what's going on.
Information after the deal's closed, but the delinquencies were far above the most likely path of delinquencies.
Mr. Vail.
Commissioner, the way I would phrase the question, I would divide it. There are two components to it. I think one of them is how the macro trends of home price, whether they increase or decrease, and then you have the borrower's behavior. And delinquencies is definitely more borrower's behavior than a macro trend. At some point, they do connect, and I think you need the third component to really connect them together, which is as home price decline and refinancing opportunities dry up, then it does magnifies the delinquency issues. In other words, if borrowers are, so to speak, feeling that they're underwater on their mortgage because they see home price declining, their first reaction would be try to get out of this financial obligation in a way that would be...
So just a little sampling of what they're talking about. And, Andrew, we don't, of course, know the full context there. But what I think that might be is linking the fact that home prices were already beginning to decline, that foreclosures were already beginning to rise, and Moody's was and the others were still giving AAA ratings to these securities derivatives.
I think that is the takeaway. And I think, you know, as you moved into sort of the end of 2006, 2007, when housing prices were still falling, there is ample evidence that for some reason or another, Moody's did not change their rating strategy, which is to say the AAA was something that they were still rating things, and that obviously was completely wrong.
Can I ask you before you go about the context of this hearing today? This is not a congressional hearing. It's the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, which I think it's fair to say was modeled loosely on the 9/11 Commission. And I wonder how you think the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission is doing. Is it being independent? Is it finding anything that anyone else hasn't already figured out? What do you think?
You know, I think thus far it's had a mixed reaction, which may be putting it politely. When you think about this commission, they haven't come up with anything completely new. In fact, I would argue Carl Levin's hearings with Goldman Sachs and some of the others were more insightful, and some of the other hearings were more interesting. The real question is what we, the taxpayers, are going to get from this commission besides a book about what took place. This book, they're writing a report similar to the way the 9/11 Commission did, but their report doesn't come out till probably November, December of this year, if not later, after, months after, hopefully, the regulatory reform bills will have already been passed. So there's a question about the value of all this, because I think initially, at least, the concept was that this commission was going to help inform the American public and the Congress about what took place and how we can fix it.
Andrew Ross Sorkin, New York Times business columnist and chief mergers and acquisitions reporter, there's a title, and author of Too Big to Fail, the inside story of how Wall Street and Washington fought to save the financial system and themselves. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, of course.
Brian Lehrer, WNYC. Coming up next, New York State is on the verge of passing a domestic workers' bill of rights. We'll find out what it means for those of you who work in other people's homes and those of you who hire those who work in your homes. Stay with us.